Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. And we are back once again from our respective TMO shipping containers to bring you another week of, well, rugby chat, but not chat about rugby so much this week. We'll explain more in a minute. JB, good evening.
Good evening, Tim Cocker. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm Phil in a resplendent, in a beautiful Stade Francais jersey there.
Hello, Tim. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's not quite the same shade of blue as the electric blue from 2001, but it's close.
It's outstanding. Just catch up on the week. Firstly, your good wives on the front line there.
Yeah, still saving lives, still working unbelievably hard, and still doing a tremendous, tremendous job in very difficult conditions.
JP doesn't want to add anything to that.
My wife has not been working so hard this week because she's awaiting the results of a coronavirus test, a China flu test. And thankfully, it came back negative, so the whole household is not on.
What about 30% of the tests are false negatives?
Brilliant. Yeah. So that's what we need to hear.
Yeah. Yeah,
so testing's a scandal.
We've also had a scare and a negative test with young Thomas. Actually, got tested on Friday because he was high temperature, bad cough, very unwell actually, but negative. And since then, has made a reasonable recovery, so all's well.
Yeah. And in your week, anything to report? Anything particularly noteworthy going on?
Seeing as we've spoken about exercise and stuff over the past few weeks, I ran my first ever half marathon earlier today.
Did you?
Yeah. I kind of have always hated long distance running, but seeing as I've been on lockdown, I've kind of got into it a little bit more. I hated the full hour and 40 minutes of it, but I got through it.
That's remarkable.
That's a decent time, that.
Hour and 38 minutes.
Yeah, that's good.
Bloody hell, not for me, thank you. Yeah,
it's pretty miserable.
Continual 5Ks throughout the week. I built myself a little home CrossFit box. I'm loving it.
With your kettlebells and your chin-up bar?
Kettlebells, chin-up bar, got some resistance bands in. I am incredibly weak.
Incredibly weak. I actually bought this book by this couple of calisthenics guys, this online book, and it's a sort of a 16-week course. And I bought it at the very start of this, thinking, right, well, I'll get the pull-up bar done, and then I'll just do that. And but unfortunately, I can't get a builder to put my pull-up bar up.
So
I've just got this pull-up bar, and I'm not going to put it up on the back of my house because anyway, I'll ruin it. Don't trust myself. But this week, my update is I got my Zwift turbo trainer properly working. Did 45 kilometers earlier today. It's good. It's really good.
What's a turbo trainer?
It's like it just makes your bike a static bike, and then you can get these little sensors on your bike, and it works out how hard you're working. And translates that into this little Zwift app. There are other apps that do this, but it sort of gamifies you riding. So it has you going around this course against other people, chucks in a King of the Mountain challenge at one point, chucks in a sprint challenge every now and again. Yeah, it's really cool.
It looks pretty good.
It's really good. I was on it for like an hour and a quarter or hour and a half nearly earlier, and I'd never do that.
No, it's like I can't really motivate myself to work out at home, but the last 3-4 days I've done it every day solidly. It's quite good fun. Well, ish.
Yeah, you need to make it part of your routine. That's the key.
Yeah, you do.
We just got to be. We've got to be in prime condition for when the drinking commences again. I'm so looking forward to those first beers in the summer. Oh my god, they're going to be so good.
That first stag do after.
I need to say something about drinking. The drinking world has been turned upside down because everyone that I think of as a big drinker per se is now not a big drinker, because all the big drinkers I know are social drinkers, but the social drinkers aren't really enjoying it. Like, I'm a social drinker. I drink a lot socially. I don't want to drink any beer at all because I like the physical interaction. Whereas people who are not particularly big drinkers have really turned into drinkers.
There's nothing better to do half the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, it is a dangerous position to be in if you've not got stuff to do and you start clock watching, thinking, is this an acceptable time for me to crack a beer?
I just worry 2 p.m. I just worry about the non-social cocaine users.
So on this podcast today, and thank you very much for listening, we're going to be it's like rugby's answer to House of Cards. There's a few sort of political and a few power shifting forces at play. And really, I think we're going to get into that. And starting with the bid to become the World Rugby President, which is a very influential position, kind of can set the tone and lead the way and be quite influential in what the game looks like in a few years' time. Can be. I mean, actually, I'm trying to think, has Bill Beaumont, what impact has he had in his tenure as president of World Rugby so far? Not a great deal.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. I really don't know. So I did some digging on this topic, and I just find it interesting because obviously it's a very important position. And I wonder if when we talk about the chairman of World Rugby, whether we have it wrong. And what we mean by that is, that's not where the political battle is. So it doesn't really matter who the chairman is eventually. That's not the battle. The battle is between World Rugby and some of the home unions who have tournaments like Six Nations and Tri Nations or Rugby Championship and whatnot, if that makes sense. It's almost like you've got to think of it like the battle for the leadership inside the Labour Party. For instance, their enemy is the Conservative Party. You know, that's where the battle is. It's not the internal battle, although maybe with the Labour Party you might say that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think you're probably right to say there's probably more, or not probably, there is definitely more difference of opinion between World Rugby and then the groups of unions. So, for example, World Rugby compared to, say, SANZAAR or the Six Nations unions. Than there is within World Rugby. And when you read through Bill Beaumont and Augustin Pichot's two declarations, their statements, there's a huge amount of overlap of them both saying the same things. And some of it you would totally expect them to be saying. So they're both saying that they're going to strengthen the financial stability of the game. They're both saying they're going to develop the women's game. No surprise there. They're both going to look to improve player welfare, obviously.
Of course.
Of course. interestingly, two of the other ones that they're both saying is, so they're both looking at governance reform through a review of World Rugby's internal structures. We don't know what that would exactly look like, but they're both putting that on. And they are both saying that they want to, they're framing it slightly differently, but both of them want to look at the international competitions and the world game and the world calendar to see how that can be restructured.
Yeah. So the other thing they have in common is they are both looking at pathways to get teams or nations into the existing events. I think that is probably the thing which are most got in common. So when you're thinking about how to cast your vote, and by the way, you can't cast your vote, but you know, if you could cast a vote, metaphorically, the way you've got to think about it is, how do you want it done? Do you want it done in a sort of moderate way, or do you want it done in a moderate way with a tiny bit of an edge? And that's the difference between these two candidates, I think.
So when I was trying to work out what the difference is, and let's just see what is the difference, because you've got Bernard Laporte going for vice president, which is a role that Gus Pichot has held. Gus Pichot's going for president, and Bill Beaumont's going for another term as president.
It's chairman and vice chairman.
Chairman.
It is the same thing.
Yeah. So the difference that I can sort of find between Pichot and Beaumont is basically Beaumont is a little bit more of the status quo.
Yes.
And kind of you can imagine the big tier one nations going that suits our interests best, and Gus Pichot's a little bit more skewed towards the Sanzar nations and tier two.
Although, yeah,
that's exactly right.
Although, so I would agree with that assessment. Although, I would clarify that by saying the seconders for their nominations contradict that, as in Pichot was seconded by Rugby Australia and Beaumont was seconded by Fiji. So there is more interest in politics at play here. And I'll elaborate on that point just a little bit because I think it is worth doing. The day after Pichot's bid was seconded by Rugby Australia, Argentina announced they were going to step down for the running for World Cup 2027, which Australia are running for. So there's an interesting trade-off between the two nations there.
Ah, yes, of course.
And with the Fiji bid. So to be honest, that I'm pointing out stuff that other people have pointed out. A chap that did it particularly well is Alan Dimmock, who's Rugby World editor. And he did a very nice little summary on Twitter of this. There is another interesting observation for Fiji, they were the official seconders of Beaumont's bid. Now, Fiji's, I can't remember his actual title, but one of their Fiji Rugby Union senior diplomats, let's say, who he is running for a World Rugby position. He has had an interesting and checkered past. He's previously not been allowed into either the UK or the USA.
is this the manslaughter dude?
Yes, because he had a Fijian conviction for, well, it was originally he was convicted of murder and it was then stepped down to manslaughter. Now, I don't know any of the politics or the background behind that, but I know he's pretty pally with the Fijian Prime Minister as well. So it's some interesting stuff going on there.
Isn't it just? Well, I tell you, in terms of politics, it's interesting that Gus Pichot doesn't have a vice, a running mate, so to speak.
And my assumption on that is that it would just automatically be Bernard Laporte. Because the rule...
No. So Laporte...
He is the only person running for vice chairman.
No.
Yeah.
No.
No, okay. Is that not how it works?
No. He is the running mate. He is like the Sarah Palin to... Bill Beaumont's John McCain, effectively, right? So he has given that role to Laporte, and therefore he will probably get the French votes. So the voting blocks, you know, obviously England will give their votes to Beaumont, then you can wrap up the French votes. So that's probably what he's done. Pichot, on the other hand, hasn't, but he will appoint someone once he gets there, which makes me wonder, how many people has he promised it to?
Well, so I would question that interpretation of it.
Oh, no, that is definitely the interpretation.
Well, no, that is an interpretation. That's not... So I'm looking at the World Rugby's website at the moment. And their announcement on this, they've only announced one person, or only one person has put themselves forward for vice chairman. And candidates. So where contested, candidates must achieve a simple majority.
Huh, there you go.
Which suggests... And my interpretation of this, and I'm sure I've seen this elsewhere, is that in both scenarios, Laporte, as things currently stand, unless another nomination comes forward, Laporte will be vice chairman for both of them.
Well, the World Club League takes a step closer to reality.
So I understand it differently. I understand it differently to that. which is, although it's not tested, although it's never been done before, Pichot, if he wins, will appoint a vice himself, which is why he is not running with someone, and Laporte is actually running with Beaumont.
Okay. Let's see how that plays out. Because if Laporte is for both of them, that is a really weird dynamic. If we're getting Laporte either way, that's a bit odd.
Well, this is kind of bled into another potential club versus country flare-up. Because as you said earlier, Phil, what both candidates to be chairman are saying is we're going to strengthen the financial situation in rugby as soon as we can. Various methods to do that have been mooted, including a full Six Nations Championship happening this autumn and writing off the one that's just happened in February. I think the reason for that would be... Oh, yeah, so effectively, they're looking at maybe making like a sort of 8 to 10 week international block in October and November, maybe like a 2 month block of international rugby, which they're saying is to fulfill a bunch of fixtures that haven't happened. But I think really it's to just stimulate a bit of cash.
Yeah. I mean, even if they do that, right. And yeah, they could, I don't see the point, because I assume people can't sit next to each other. I assume people can't go to corporate. I assume they'll still have to pay. I mean, they've still have to pay the players their match fee, but not have any of the income.
Well, they'll get... So, I'm with you, Jay. I can't see you having 80,000 people cram into Twickenham by October. It might happen, but in my head, it won't happen this year. That kind of stuff might not happen until we have a true, fully rolled out vaccine. It's TBC that there would still be income, obviously, through TV deals, through marketing and all the rest of it, but it would be limited, but it would bring more revenue than not having those games.
Yeah, but it depends, doesn't it, how much they're going to have to shell out on everything else. I mean, it costs a lot to open the stadium, costs a lot for security, costs a lot to pay the players. Yeah, and with the opportunity cost, I guess, is the Premiership. They may as well just play the Premiership, and then also if you play those games early on, so if you have an early Six Nations, would you not just be better having a later Six Nations, hopefully a bit fuller?
Yeah. I think you would, but I think they're looking at options at the moment, and a sort of slightly scaled back Six Nations.
How do you scale it back?
No. That's a good point. I can't remember. I was reading it today in the rugby paper, and it's been written about elsewhere.
So I can only assume that they are currently scenario planning, because it totally no one knows what it's going to look like in. No one knows what the state of lockdown will look like in May. Never mind September, October, November.
Yeah, so that's
all good scenario planning, and they will be looking at that whatever can potentially. Yeah. Bring the most money in the shortest period of time.
I think I've just remembered how the Six Nations came about. It would be a full Six Nations if nations like Japan or Australia or New Zealand aren't able to travel to the Northern Hemisphere.
Okay. That would make sense. But then, I mean, one of the key points for World Rugby at the moment, for both the chairman, for all the rugby clubs, for the RPA, for everyone in the game, is player welfare. And there will be massive player welfare issues going on whenever we can start playing rugby again, because you cannot square off all the games that need to happen in the various different leagues and have that player welfare position met, shall we say.
Well, on that front, just to summarise where we're at with domestic rugby as well, I believe, is that they haven't called that the season is over, still hoping to finish this particular season. And what would happen is there would be a 5 to 6 weeks lead-in period where clubs would be told and given time to prepare for the resumption of a league, which they are happy to resume even as late as August, I believe.
Madness.
With it potentially finishing by the end of September, very early October, with the thought then that you would have maybe a week or 2 weeks off and then start the next season.
They do it in the top 14, so why not?
but just on player welfare grounds, you cannot do that. Like,
well, hold your horses there, because we'll talk about that more in a second. I'd like to ask a few more fundamental questions, right? Which is, why is the RFU so hand to mouth? I mean, why is it that one bunch of games, one year's worth of games disappearing from the calendar, leads to a 50 million quid black hole? Why is there not an endowment fund? Why have adults not been in the room to make sure that this is the case? I know the RFU is part business, I know that. But it's also part custodian of the game. In fact, you might argue it's more custodian of the game than it is a business. Why they don't have a huge endowment fund to cover these sort of things is beyond me. I mean, it can't be right that, particularly when your stadium's in London and all the things that may happen in London, whether it be terrorist, I mean, there's not going to be an earthquake, but you never know, terrorist attack, pandemic, what have you. But the game could be so fragile in the case of just a single year's worth of games not happening.
It's a very good point. It's a fair point. Now, from their own statement, some of those losses were because of additional expenditure due to 2019 and the loss of revenue from losing autumn tests in 1 year. But it's not like those things weren't known. Five years ago, 10 years ago, that would be happening.
Own all the rugby. I mean, imagine owning a sport. How do you get it wrong? You're not making anything. You own a sport. And it's not as if the fan base is the rugby league fan base. You know, it's not. These are wealthy people. I mean, God knows what the net worth of Twickenham is on a match day. But it is beyond me.
It's millions on pork scratchings alone, which you have to pay about five quid a pack.
Yeah. But I mean, just the net worth of the people who go to watch rugby. You know, I can't understand why there is not some sort of endowment fund, and not only for Twickenham, but maybe for every club. And the people that are going to get to grips with these issues are the people that realise that that's how rugby should be run.
It is interesting you say that, because now we're in this situation. You sort of think, with all of the vast resources that the RFU has, with all the commercial partnerships it has and such, that almost it should be rugby's version of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund.
Yes. Do you know what the irony of it is? Look at the sponsors. Quilter, Investec. You know, it's in the, you know, it's basically all these people from the City of London. Well, sorry, financial firms. It's near the City of London. Yeah, you know, and they just don't like idiots. I mean, it's not like they didn't have the expertise available to them. It's not like there's not people packing in Twickenham that know all about this stuff, and yet nothing.
Yeah, well, that lack of funding for the RFU is going to cause additional hardships and additional difficulties in England. But had they had millions of pounds, they still wouldn't have been able to solve the problem that you've got with the league and the problem you've got with closing the season out when there are multiple different stakeholders, all of whom have slightly different objectives and interests in the game, which is the sheer number of stakeholders and the range of interests. And even if you take the clubs, for example, the range of different objectives from the club's perspective is quite incredible. Like the reports today coming out of the Rugby Paper, that a large number of the clubs are looking for future reductions in salary caps.
All but two, apparently.
Yeah, which is, I'm surprised it's at that level.
Yeah, and to wrap up what you're saying next, we can move on to that. I think you're absolutely right, Phil. And I think it just highlights what we have been saying for a while now, which is that the varied interest of the RFU means it's not very agile or focused at times like this, when it has to cater for the grassroots of the game and also the elite level of the game.
Yeah.
They're two very, very, very different propositions. And it's almost impossible for any organisation to tend to both adequately at the same time.
And I wonder if that's a problem. I wonder if the problem is because they've been pulled apart by these two different poles. Like, hey, you need to be a business. Hey, you need to be custodians of the game. Hey, you need to promote Team England. Hey, you need to do grassroots. Because of that, the only thing they can come up with to prove that they are doing what as they say is just to keep spending money. Like, just keep throwing money at the community game. Oh, it's okay. We spent X amount of millions. That's why we're so good, because of how much we spend. And actually, that isn't the secret to rugby. It's not how many millions get centrally. It's what your club brings through its members. You know, the ethos of the club, how people band together to run the thing. So you're right, Tim. It doesn't seem to be a cohesive unit or a cohesive organisation to manage all the different things that it needs to manage. Maybe they should separate it off.
They pick it up on what you said, though, about the, yeah, you're right. I read 9, and JB, you've heard 10. So it's, anyway, the point is, it's the majority and a significant majority of Premiership rugby clubs, it seems, were asking for a reduction in the salary cap, and a couple of clubs, and I think we're guessing, probably quite an educated guess that Bristol and Bath will be probably among them.
Yeah.
Probably, you would imagine, with very wealthy Definitely. Benefactors who have been, you know, not slow to put their hand in their pocket. They're sort of vetoing it, and it works in that fashion. I think your take on it, Phil, was exactly where I was, which is like, wow, already that many are saying, right, we need to cut our cloth.
Yeah, and so just in terms of the actual logistics of doing it, just in terms of going from 7 million at the moment down to what is reported at 5.5, it could be more or less, but just a cut of that level is significant. You're talking, your marquee players are outside this, but you're talking probably 5 of your top players going, or 10 plus of your lower level players going.
Well, hold that thought, okay, because a reduction in the salary cap has certain issues, doesn't it? You're going to have legacy contracts and new contracts. So if you're lucky enough to be on a 5-year on £250,000 a year, which is pretty much non-existent, I'd be amazed if there's a single player who has 5 years to run on £250,000 in the Premiership. Amazed.
Very, very few. Someone has just re-signed a contract.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but according to Brian Moore, there are hundreds of players on 400,000 plus, according to him. If you've got that to run, that's going to continue to run. And I think the way you'd have to work it out, it has to be a really complex, it would be complex. It has to be percentage of your salary cap. So you have the old salary cap of 6 million, the new one of 4 million. And then when that player comes up for renegotiation, you can offer him the same salary cap percentage.
Yeah, but that would solve the problem down the line. But that transition, say, from now to next season, if that's when the shift is, that's a brutal transition.
Well, for the players, and also for the club, it's not that bad, because they can demonstrate, can't they, to banks and whoever, that they've got a solid business plan, and this is how the cash flow is going to work going forward.
Yeah, I'm more thinking about the players, because you offer two options to the player, exactly as you said. Look, here is your reduced salary, you're down the road.
Well, this is an issue rugby's going to have to deal with, and I think they will when all this comes back. But the RPA really need to get some guys in there who are coming up with these ideas and talking more about the commercial side. I mean, in the way that the RFU are conflicted over all the things that it's meant to do. The RPA do some things really well, and one of the things it doesn't do particularly well is look after the financials, in my opinion. They're going to have to get to grips with this pretty quickly, because should they decide to lower the salary cap, the players have got very little bargaining power. You know, Australian rugby is not in a good place.
New Zealand rugby as well.
The potential cuts to salary in Australia up to 80% and 50% in New Zealand.
I mean, that's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we're in a bad position, but we might not be that bad. You know, what is the Rand? 25 to the pound. Yeah. You know, you can see just by the recruitment of Sale Sharks that you can get some tremendous value from South Africa.
Incredible.
And that's going to continue. So that's going to leave you with France, Japan, the UK, and France have got
Ireland. Well, the odd player in Ireland, if you're very lucky to be one of the few.
If you get that one slot in fine.
Yeah, there's one slot in each position available, unless you can be a project player. But that is much more difficult than it was because it's a 5-year rule.
Yeah. So France have got that rule, haven't they, where you've got to come through the academy or you've got to be French qualified or some such thing.
And yeah, which means Montpellier have got academies in Bloemfontein and Stellenbosch and wherever else, Pretoria.
Yeah, I would have been using my lockdown period to learn Japan if I was a rugby player. 100%.
I mean, there's no guarantee that the Japanese are not exactly forthcoming when it comes to handing out visas and whatnot. And it wouldn't surprise me if their take on Western, the filthy Western, non-wearing mask society would be pretty strict. And they don't have even their teams don't have unlimited money. I mean, they have one or two professionals each.
We've seen Dan Carter, Matt Gitto have both said that they are done in Japan. They were on contracts for at least the rest of the season. Kieran Reid has said he's unlikely to ever go back. So even Japan is not unaffected by this.
From a player's point of view, if there was one saving grace with this whole situation, is that it sort of came up really well and truly in January, February, March, rather than October, November, December, because a lot of contracts get signed by January.
Yeah.
Now there are exceptions, and there are players who are in a very, very bad position being on the open market now. Friend of the pod, Carl Ferns, being one of them. Nick Abendanen spoke up recently about being another. They're quite relatively in-demand players. So if they're struggling, then if you're a jobbing rugby player out of contract this summer,
it's terrible timing. Terrible, terrible timing.
Ironically, and this doesn't sound particularly logical, but I think if you're a jobbing rugby player, you might be in a better situation. Purely for the fact that it's not, I mean, let's face it, it's not going to be easy for anyone when all the markets are open. But it's easier to replace 40 grand a year than it is 300 grand a year.
Yeah.
Or and 800 grand a year or whatever.
Yeah. No, that's a fair comment.
Yeah.
That's a fair comment.
You can even walk away from the game, and so what? But if you really are relying on that, you know, last couple of years to make up, you know, mortgage payments, that's when you're going to be in a world of pain.
Here's another scenario. Let's say you are 32, you've been a loyal servant for a club, and you've just signed a 2 or 3 year deal to finish your career on good money.
Yeah.
Knowing that's your last contract, and if you swerve that or you don't get that, you're not going to get another one in the current market, would you be charitable and say, okay, I'll take a massive cut?
No.
Just go, no, this is it, this is the rest of my money from rugby. I'd understand that perspective.
I wouldn't take a cut.
It would be very, very difficult to accept a cut. But then I can only assume that there will be some kind of unilateral termination clause in these contracts where exceptional circumstances can be invoked, like the current position we're in. And they might, I'm not saying there is this, but there might be an option for the club to say, look, if the salary cap gets reduced from 7 down to 5, or given the position that we're in, we're going to rip up that contract.
And a worrying thing for the players now, I say worrying, it's not worrying, but here is a fault line. Here's something which will happen. Is previously with the furlough scheme, it was just implied, you know, you go on it, nothing needs to be signed, away you go. Well, that's changed now. You do need to sign something to go on it. So players need to get very good advice as to what is in these contracts, because you might come to a situation, as I mentioned last week or week before, where you sign this thing and you don't really understand what it is, and then you're up for renegotiation anyway. And that, you know, that is a real possibility.
Yeah, and that would be worrying from a player's perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting on all of this, there was a very interesting announcement from Saracens early this week about their players. So not just their players, all of their staff over £75,000 a year are being having all future payments deferred. To at least next season.
Now, is that a furlough and defer situation?
So it didn't. I don't think it clarified that. It wasn't hugely forthcoming with details. I would assume so, because it would make sense. That you don't require, certainly those players, you don't require them right now. You might be able to recover a few thousand pounds through furloughing them. And then that will obviously go to Saracens, but then to the players. Mm. And then the remainder of their money. And so if you take one of their star players who might be on £500,000 a year, who would be earning their gross salary would be somewhere in the region of 40 to 45K per month, you might be recouping £2,500 of that, paying it to them. But then the entirety of the difference would be deferred to a later point, which is, it's massive if you've got a mortgage.
Was Owen Farrell named in this?
The only
player, yes, he was.
Named, so, well, all I think it was all staff. The announcement was all staff.
But they did have a picture of Owen Farrell in one of the reports saying, including Owen Farrell, have agreed.
Well, yeah, I think it is all of them. And certainly the player who was part of the official Saracens statement was Mario Itoje. So he'll be close to one of the highest paid players there. Certainly if you count his image rights and appearance fee attendances.
Oh, I miss being able to just talk about those days and that being the big talking point.
The easy things. So it has massive implications for the players right now who've got mortgages and the rest of it. But it also has huge implications for the salary cap down the line, because what they were saying was that balance will be paid over potentially up to 18 months from whenever the next season starts. Now, under the current salary cap regulations, that would be counted in the next season. It's counted in the season that it's paid in, not for the season that it's from.
Yeah.
So Saracens must be assuming that they will not be bound by the current salary cap rules when they will be paying this. Now, that could be for a whole host of reasons.
I think there's there's a bit more politics behind it than that.
Well, so that they have to be assuming that.
I see what you're saying.
They have to be assuming that they will not be bound by the current salary cap regulations when they pay those fees down the line.
So it's almost
we don't know what they're assuming they will be bound by. It could be they're in a different league. It could be the rules have been changed.
Dare I say, one of the reasons why people, I mean, Owen Farrell maybe is a very different example because his value is so high, but dare I say, perhaps one of the reasons why Saracens can do this, where they defer all staff payments and it's not massively necessarily adversely affecting players in terms of mortgage stuff, is because Saracens as a club has been very, very good at getting players very financially organised and alternative income streams, or in a way that, as you identified, the RFU have struggled to have a really substantial rainy day fund to cater for all eventualities.
Do you guys know how Nigel Murray made his money?
I know he's got lots of different businesses, but I've definitely read it, but I can't remember. Is it not
Domino's?
I was going to say it's not Domino's, is it? I was going to say Domino's or Blockbuster. But
Domino's pizza franchises.
Really?
Wow.
And also, apparently he's got a biography out called Skin in the Game, which you can't buy online. Apparently you can only buy it in the club shop, from what I understand. So if there's anyone out there who has a copy of Skin in the Game, get in contact with me and post it me, because I really want to read it.
I'd like to read that. But how that gets squared from a Saracens perspective is very interesting.
All right.
And that would fly in face of the 5.5, if there is a salary cap reduction to 5.5, that doubles their problem in future.
So let me ruminate a second.
Okay.
So Saracens find themselves in a position where they're relegated, but they actually hold a lot of cards. Every other club in the country is furloughing or actually reducing pay. Some of them are saying that they will refund later on. So Gloucester have given a promise to their players, which is kind of, we will give you some money, maybe. If we recover, we'll pay you back, is basically the thing.
Okay.
Saracens have said, no, we're going to just defer and everyone can match it. So they can put financial pressure onto the other clubs. Simultaneously, because of this financial pressure, things are now in play. For instance, ring fencing, which would probably be led by Saracens, and needs the agreement of all 13 shareholders?
Yes. Yeah.
Is there?
Everyone plus Newcastle. Yeah. The 12 in the Premiership plus Newcastle.
14 shareholders then.
13.
14.
12 plus CBC. One in the Championship. Oh, CBC. Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
But CBC only have a share in Topco, which is the image and TV rights, rather than the clubs or the league. Is that right?
That is actually completely correct.
So I don't know if that stretches to a vote in things like salary cap.
And I'm pretty sure they wouldn't care either, would they?
Let's say 13.
Let's just say, for argument's sake, that we don't know.
13 or 14.
Yeah. So Saracens could quite conceivably see themselves back in the top competition if things get bad enough. I mean, I think they'd like to see someone go under. So, you know, if Worcester can't sell all their land to build a housing development, for instance, and go bankrupt, you could easily see Saracens back. And the Premiership teams more than ever need Nigel Wray. They need owners with money. They need people who are willing to fund rugby. And I think it's pretty smart by Saracens to be doing what they're doing, and also to be leading the move for, or driving the move for ring fencing, which I understand that they are.
So them driving the move, because that's not being reported at the moment, is it?
Well, some people haven't done their jobs.
I've not seen it reported.
Well, it's been reported by me right now.
There you go, breaking news.
Breaking news. So I think that's a smart strategy by Saracens. No matter which way they break it down, of course, they'd be able to say that they qualify. Either as a shareholder, they qualify, or as a team in the Premiership this year. Because you wouldn't ring fence from being a team in the Premiership next year, would you?
Someone will come up with a conspiracy that Nigel Wray paid for a virus.
Well, he can pay for a podcast if he really wants.
So you say they qualify. Again, they would have to have the salary cap regulations changed for them to be playing in the Premiership next year, because
I think
they haven't met the conditions for the past, well, X number of years.
Yeah, and I think at that point they've got a lot of leeway to be forgiven. But then, you know, if you want Saracens back, or if they get back in the league, I do not see Saracens saying to anyone, yeah, let's get rid of some salary cap. If anything, it's going to be uncapped.
Yeah, they'll be pushing for a significant increase so they can keep all their players.
Yeah, if they've proved one thing, they're a phenomenally loyal bunch of people. Phenomenally loyal. So, good luck. Pick your poison, lads.
God, I really don't... There are so many vested interests, stakeholders, so many different opinions in this. I really can't see how it's all going to get squared. I mean, in terms of just, if you just break it down really simply, how do you finish this season? In my head, the simplest answer is you don't. You can't. You write this season off.
Okay. So people with influence in the game hopefully listen to this podcast. I know they do. We love to think about things which are unthinkable. So sadly, we are going to lose some rugby clubs. That is my firm belief. Some will go, and also some top clubs will be looking at this situation very, very differently to the top clubs. So, you know, I'm sure London Irish have a different view on what's going on to Bristol and Bath.
Yeah,
definitely. I don't know that for a fact, but you know, different organisations will be looking at this in different ways. I honestly think if ring fencing is going to go ahead, we've got to revisit how we can incorporate ring fencing and relegation. So, you know, the idea of having one team not play every year, 13 shareholders, I think is realistic. Particularly.
Have you, because you've been banging that drum for a little while now.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a positive response from anyone on it?
Yes, today.
Who? Do you want to...
I'm not going to name names.
Okay.
But think about it. I mean, what would it happen if that 13th team who wasn't playing was followed around by a Netflix film crew for the entire year whilst they rebuild?
I mean, surely you lose one of the biggest parts of those Netflix documentaries, which is the building up to the games and then the post-match stuff. So it'd just be guys doing the same.
No, but you get, think about it, you get all those montages like Dolph Lundgren in Rocky with just players running around science labs getting made massive.
Now, do you know, it'd be more like the NFL Hard Knocks. Now, are you aware of the Scottish draft system?
No.
So in Scotland, every one of their professional players is also drafted by a local club. Are you aware of that?
No.
Okay, so Glasgow Warriors. At the start of the season, all the teams affiliated to Glasgow Warriors, it might actually be all the teams in the next division of
So these are all the teams that I remember used to play. So all the teams, all the clubs you'll be talking about are all the ones that I remember used to seeing on Rugby Special.
Yeah.
10-second clips back in the 80s and 90s. So like Melrose.
Hoik, or if that's Hoik. How you say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they get to draft all of the professional players.
Sterling,
yeah. I don't know what accent that is.
Bigger potentially next year. Because I think they were due to get promoted. But
who?
Bigger.
Who are they?
Scottish Rugby Club.
Oh, lovely. So they all get to draft the players from the Warriors and Edinburgh. And they have some really... Actually, I've just gone on a tangent here. They have some really weird draft strategies. So who do you draft?
Let's get that televised.
That is very interesting, actually.
Yeah, who would you draft?
I would watch that, just because I'm that desperate for sport. I'm going to be watching, as I mentioned last week, I'll be watching the NFL draft next weekend. That's my entertainment for the weekend.
For one thing, you're not going to draft anyone who's anywhere near the Scotland squad.
No.
Exactly.
Certainly you're not going to waste your early picks on them. You're going to draft, say, third choice, fullback, number eight, scrum half, fly half, those third choice in key positions. Third and choice also, tight end prop.
What positions do you draft? So do you just draft? Say if you've got tight end
props. So clubs have loads of props. Just get props.
Yeah. So or do you just say, I'm going to draft every second row because they can't all be playing at the same time, can they?
That's yeah. So draft six deep in back rows.
Yeah. So that's literally.
So you're always going to guarantee yourself to have a starting number eight. Of that quality.
Right at the bottom of these drafts, the best players go. So I'm pretty sure Stuart Hogg has played a game or two coming back from injury for one of these players. Yeah. Kenny Murray, the coach of Glasgow, I did an interview with him and he was telling me about the draft process. So here is why I'm saying that. Say if Sale Sharks went down onto the naughty step, their players could be drafted by the local clubs that they affiliate to, whether it be Preston or Central.
We talked about this as a silly idea when you muted this a few weeks back. We said, what about, that'd be cool as well, televise that.
So they can either go out or they can go to other clubs. If they want their players to continue playing, they can go to Preston or whatnot. But if anyone else wants to come and poach them, they can come and poach them. They've got a year to sign and recruit, get a new coaching team in. Of course, you wouldn't need a new coaching team at Sale. I'm just using them as an example because the current coaching team is perfectly good enough. but yeah, that's exactly what you would do. And actually, it's a really, really good prospect. You keep ring fencing, you keep relegation, and...
The only way it could work if it was all centralised and all the money went into one pot, because otherwise you'd go bust.
Yeah, you'd have to have a pot. So basically, the remaining 12 teams have to fund your salary cap.
Yeah. So that now you've had a chance to flesh this out a little bit more and think about the consequences of the relegation. I hate it less. I'll definitely say that.
It's a great idea, Phil.
I'm still not totally on board. But
imagine the opening weekend at Welford Road, because they would have gone down. If it wasn't Saracens, they would have gone down. Imagine the opening day at Welford Road. They've got a year with Borthwick and Murphy. Yeah, it's exciting.
You can imagine like Craig Doyle going and let's cross the Welford Road where Tim Cocker, what's happening? Nothing, mate.
Nothing.
Just getting rid of these cobwebs up here.
I mean, it seems wrong though, doesn't it? But there again, there's a stadium. There, you know, Leicester Tigers have a ladies team. Maybe the ladies play. Maybe they still play A-League. But it would certainly whet the appetite for rugby when that team returns.
Yeah, And a winner of this would be those women's rugby teams in the relegated or the naughty step team.
Yeah.
You get much more attendance at Leicester or Tiger or Sale.
Yeah. Do you know? Yeah, go on, Jay.
I was going to say, so I'm aware that there are people out there who like it when I do their job. I've done it for you again. Go and implement that, because it's a great idea.
Now, do you know what I watched a little bit of earlier today? I watched a virtual Grand Prix.
How was it?
I watched it out of curiosity as much as anything.
The Chinese one?
Yes. Oh, no, that was the first one. They've done a new one. That was 2 weeks ago. They've done another one today. But they had F1 drivers and people like Ian Poulter and a postman from Derby and various people playing this video game Grand Prix. But the fact they had all the camera angles and it looked so realistic, it was a very ingenious bit of television to make in this current situation.
Because of the F1 docs on Netflix, which I cannot recommend enough, I think I would listen to 4 F1 podcasts yesterday because I'm just hooked. And I was watching a video, which I thought was legitimate. I thought it was a 2018 F1 car against one of the Brabhams from 88, from 82. And I thought, oh, it must be in Goodwood or somewhere like that. It wasn't. It was the bloody computer game. And it was so realistic. It took me a good 30 seconds. I thought, bloody hell, I'm watching a computer game.
It's only when they spin and crash and then go kind of like see-through so that other cars don't crash into them or whatever that you realise. But it was ingenious. But it did make me think, and allied to this, I read an article a couple of days ago with Jack Knoll. I don't know if you saw him. He's taken part over this weekend in a FIFA competition.
Yeah.
And he said that the England squad is absolutely mad on FIFA. That Mako Vanapola is the best in the England squad at FIFA. Henry Slade is the worst. They're also massive on Fortnite and Call of Duty. Ellis Genge recently was in a Call of Duty. No, he's in a League of Legends or something like that. Match or something like that, which got put out on streaming. We've got Jamal Ford Robinson, who's becoming quite a prolific Twitcher.
Twitch, yeah.
Slowly losing the plot as well.
Beautifully losing the plot.
MHD, Luke Cowan-Dickie is a big, big gamer. He was at one point, I think, ranked number one in the world or very close to
I'm just reading that now. This quote from Jack Knoll, yeah, he said, Anthony Watson's good, but Mako is very good. On Fortnite, Luke Cowan-Dickie and Call of Duty, he's amazing. He was number one in the world on Search and Destroy a couple of years ago.
Can I just say, right, this is not a joke. It is harder to be number one in the world at Call of Duty, Search and Destroy than it is to play for England at hooker. I mean,
I'd probably agree with that. Just in terms
and it's
of
the probably more lucrative, too.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So I've never watched any esports at all, but I listened to a very good podcast that I got recommended that was a sports lawyer interviewing an MD at an esports company, and it was I think CJ, friend of the pod, recommended it. It was a fascinating insight just in terms of the numbers that they were talking, like 18-year-old kids who are best in the world at whatever it is, FIFA, League of Legends, Call of Duty, Fortnite, all the rest of them, signing for multi-million pound deals.
It's mad, isn't it?
To play for these teams. But it's actually because they've brought in people who, professionals, legal, accountancy, management, all the rest of it, who have done... They've all done entertainment industry, so they've done music, they've done films, or they've done sports. It's actually an incredibly developed market already, and they're very, very switched on people, maximizing the opportunities for these guys and girls.
Podcast legend Adam Carolla, recently did his stand-up show in a venue in California, which is the Esports Stadium.
Yeah. Yeah, the
stadium. I'm sure it's in like 20,000, 30,000 big.
You were saying the production value. So when it's on TV or when you actually go to one of these competitions, they say saying the production values is like a Hollywood blockbuster combined with a Broadway musical. It's just meant to be.
You mean WWE?
Yeah, precisely.
I watched a little I don't know how it went down this YouTube wormhole one time, but I watched I ended up watching about a 10-minute documentary of this gamer who's one of those people, like you say, that had this multi-million pound endorsement deal with an energy drink company or something and was part of a team on whatever it was, let's say League of Legends, I don't know, Fortnite. And it was like watching a elite athlete preparing for the Olympics, the way he was like, an alarm went off. Sorry, he had to stop the chat. Sorry, I need to drink. I need to have some water. Because he had like the correct amount of fluid in his system, like a tiny percent, because like at the top level, as you say, it's a very developed thing. And there is the gap between being the best and just not quite being there is so minute.
He was like 10,000 compared to being the top 10, like in rugby.
Now, it's quite funny, isn't it? I do get the reason why you'd want highly caffeinated, sugar-based drinks for sport. But for eSport, it doesn't sound like the wisest solution.
Yeah, but the number is bang on the demographic, because you've like 15 to 25-year-old or 15 to 30-year-old blokes are watching that stuff in the millions and billions.
Yeah, but they shouldn't be drinking. You know, if your thing is Call of Duty 24 hours a day, don't have sugary drinks. That's what I'm saying.
Well, the one thing that struck me about this is I was sort of thinking, when I, not to cast any sort of, I've done my fair share of gaming in my time, Football Manager, I'd have done so much better at school if it hadn't been for Football Manager, my God. I was kind of struck with these, Jack Knoll talking about it and going and doing a FIFA tournament and LS Genge and stuff, because they're quite gregarious, outgoing guys, very social, the whole rugby thing. And I didn't sort of think of that with the gaming thing, but it's clearly quite a big thing with young rugby players. But then I remembered what it was like living with my brother when he was playing at Bath. And
the who was he living with?
Sorry?
Who was he living with? Any other Bath
players? Well, me and him got our first house in Bath. I was studying there and he came to play rugby. So we got 110% mortgage or something and just got a house. Cause it was, remember those days?
Before 2008 then.
Yeah, exactly. So, and we lived with another guy called Steve, who was playing at Bath as well. He's now a very, very good coach, Steve Salvin, in Yorkshire. Anyway, I think he might be at Leeds. Anyway, doesn't matter. But, so the two of them would come back from training and they were so knackered, they just got a massive bowl of food and just sat playing games all day. And that's probably why, isn't it? You're doing so much training that in the rest of your time, you've got no energy.
And the alternative as well. So like back in the day, if you ever read about footballers in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, 70s, before sports nutrition, before the rest of it, they would finish training and go to the pool hall, the snooker hall and get on it.
And that's true, actually.
As young men, when you've got free time, you can drink and party.
But those guys back then would have gone. If you could have had a chat with one of those guys back in the 60s, in George Best era footballers, and you explained Tinder, think how jealous they'd be.
Do you know, not at all. Not at all. When I watch I watched a clip of Maradona today warming up in the 80s in Napoli or early 90s. I thought that is the era to be a young man.
To get away with it.
Yeah. I mean, that is, you know, being an international jet setter then, that was definitely the time.
There's meant to be an amazing Maradona documentary, actually, which he's one of my favourite just sports people. Him back in the day was just ridiculous. People saying Messi's better than him need to absolutely do one.
Because
he managed to do what he's doing whilst being walloped by everyone around him. People just kicking his leg, just kicking him.
And walloped off the field as well.
Well, yeah, very true. But with the whole gaming thing, it sort of made me think, well, we talked about the fact there's no rugby game and rugby needs a video game, but that's where we're at. But if they did have one and they had a challenge mode, you know, these things where they say you have to go through challenges harder to easier. What challenge modes could we come up with? So, for example, a good challenge mode would be, well, what the 1999 World Cup comeback from France that we had. It would be, there's 30 minutes gone and you are 12 points down to the All Blacks.
Yeah, so they have these.
Find a way to come back and win.
The NFL games, they have these and they're great fun.
Yeah, I think so. There'll be some good ones like that. I mean, the Leicester comeback against Stade, the Leinster comeback against Northampton.
Oh, yeah.
Some of those would be incredible. I'd like the individual player challenges within the game. So, like, make one of your back rows make 38 tackles in a European Cup semi-final against Clermont. Yes.
But I don't know how this game's playable.
What do you mean?
I can't figure out for life of me how you make the mechanics of a rugby game.
Have you never played one?
Yeah, I have. But how do you then make one player tackle 30 odd people? The only way you can do it is like pre-program or have line-up. I don't know. I don't know how you can do it.
You'd have to have more freedom for individual players in the defensive line. So you know how in a lot of the games you can shuffle through the players. So you can pick which player you are currently controlling. So obviously when you're attacking, you're always controlling the player with the ball. But when you're defending, if you can pick one of the players to control.
Or maybe you just play the game. Maybe you'd have to play the game just as Jack Berger and make 38 tackles.
Now that would be
exhausting.
It would be exhausting.
But obviously another one you could have is maybe one of the early challenges. There's 5 minutes to go in a World Cup pool match. Against South Africa, you're 4 points down. In Brighton, you're Japan. Yeah. Find a way to win. You need to go the length of the field to win.
You're a significantly smaller, weaker team with far less pedigree.
Or it could be you're Wales. You're playing against 13 men. Beat Australia.
You've got a 3-on-1 overlap. George North is playing number 13, playing outside centre.
So, where it falls down for me, right, is how do you... This sounds so nausea, right? How do you put in a team structure? How do you select the calls which you're going to use?
So, from what I've played, it's all kind of preset.
It's rubbish. It's a little bit like Madden at scrum and line-out. But not very developed.
Yeah.
I can't really work out how it happened.
I think a rugby game would happen and it would be good if there was enough demand. There's clearly just not enough demand to warrant the good game developers that make games like Madden.
Too hard to make them
bothered to do it. Well, they managed it. Lomu was great. I spent hours playing Lomu, loved it.
The thing about Lomu is it accurately depicted the amount of skill in the game at that time. That was as fast as it got.
And the problem in rugby is the decision making from so many more people is so critical from so many more people. Whereas in a rugby game, you can control one person at a time. That's a fundamental flaw because the line running and the decision making and the movement and all the rest of it from so many more people is so integral to the way that the game works.
You'd probably be making decisions. This again, I apologize, this is so nausea, but you're probably making decisions, aren't you? It's like the halfback, right? So, or you know, your L1 or R1 for pass right. But actually, probably more important decision is how many men committed to the breakdown.
Yeah.
Who won that breakdown?
Yeah, or the outside running line, the dummy running line.
Yes.
Do you fix the outside shoulder or the inside shoulder of the outside defender, like that kind of thing? Do you check his run? Do you put an arm out to slow his run, to risk getting penalised, but also buy the man outside you an extra half a yard?
Yeah, you're right. The more you talk, the more I'm thinking. What I thought when I read the Jack Knoll thing was like, oh, Jack Knoll's taking part in a gaming competition and he's doing it in football. But this is why, isn't it? Football's just a pig's bladder and two bits of metal at each end. That's it.
Yeah. So, what was the game that we watched? What was the first game that we... Oh, the France-New Zealand game. Yeah. The rucks were simple. All eight players that could get to the ruck got to the ruck. And then if you're really good with the ball, you either kick it or run around people. And that was it. Yeah. That was it. Nothing more to it than that.
Very simple. There was no thought going into where the back three were standing. They were just they just found themselves in a position.
Had no idea about positional play.
They found themselves stood in a position on the field and the ball either came to them or it didn't.
I would genuinely love, though, particularly with what's happened in the last year, I'd love a rugby management game.
Yeah. Now that would be interesting. God, I'd hate some of the decisions that the clubs have got to think through right now. There are some very, very tough decisions being made. On the rugby game, that was one of the different objectives from Beaumont and Pichot. Pichot did flag that a flagship rugby computer game as one of his objectives for World Rugby, which it seems like something that is outside of the control of World Rugby.
Yeah, whereas Beaumont just wanted to relaunch the rugby Sabutio game.
But this goes back to maybe one of the issues rugby has in terms of growing it, is like, I think on the one hand, Pichot's probably thinking, well, if we want to market ourselves and grow our game, we need to have things like a video game. And that might, because look at the number of young guys, potential rugby players, that are into gaming. Exactly as you said, there are stadiums. The problem being, you can't just pick up a rugby game and understand what the hell is going on, which goes back to what I was saying again last week, which is, if rugby wants to grow, if rugby wants a video game that you can make easily, simplification is probably the key word. But then you ruin some of the nuance that we love.
And actually,
exactly. And also, just remember this: when Pichot says that he wants a game, I mean, that's nice, and we think he's really cool and young because he wears trainers. Is he not nearly 50?
Yeah. By the way, he should be disqualified from any high office on the strength of wearing trainers with a suit alone.
I agree.
I would never ever do it, but it's a bit like booing the kicker or shining lasers into the eyes of the kicker. While none of us could get away with it, Pichot, maybe he can.
Yeah, but I don't mind, because wasn't there an Argentinian rugby team? We saw a picture of them stood by an aeroplane going to a World Cup or something, or a tour, and they were wearing suits.
This year's or last year's World Cup squad, they all wore trainers.
Yeah, but they didn't wear running trainers. That was the problem. Gus Pichot had like some Asics running trainers with his suit.
I'm not doing it anytime soon, but I don't mind it.
One thing I was thinking then about the rugby, maybe that is the place for Rugby X. Maybe you could accurately replicate Rugby X.
No, do you know what you could accurately do? No word of a lie.
Go on.
Rugby League. It lends itself so well to rugby games.
Yeah, it's the simplified version of the game. Yeah.
No one wants to play Rugby X. Everyone wants to play Rugby League.
Not that many people.
Who wants to play Rugby X?
Well, no one really wants to play either. That's the problem.
That is not true. Rugby League is the greatest game on earth. So let's finish off with this. Did you see the reports that if the season was to resume, it would be all at Twickenham?
Yeah. It did sound a bit far-fetched. Again, it sounded like someone's scenario planning without actually thinking everything through.
Why did you say that?
Well, just the number of people who are going to have to come into contact with one another in one space at Twickenham to do that. And also, you're going to have to relay the pitch. You can't play 47 games on a grass pitch.
I thought it could take it because it's a hybrid.
So it's 5% weave. So my assumption would be it won't be able to take 47 games without replacing it. I don't know.
So I thought it could do. Or they could split it between there and the Rico.
Yeah.
So the Rico would work because, it's the centre of the country. Mm-hmm. And also, it's got accommodation. It's got good Wi-Fi. I mean, the Rico would probably be a better place for it. Or you could run two locations.
Yeah.
Oh, and apparently, I never knew this. Maybe Tim knows this. They could film it using remote cameras from Stratford.
Really?
Yeah, that's amazing. You didn't
need cameraman?
No.
Yeah, sorry, I have heard of this.
Have you? How's it work? Do you know?
You get less options, and you can't be, you can't have the reactive stuff that you get. Like some of the best shots are the ones of the guys running up and down the touchline where they just get exactly the right angle at the right time for a try or whatever. But yeah, you can produce sporting events remotely by people controlling cameras that are in fixed positions in another location.
So yeah, they do that from the Rico because of the quality of the Wi-Fi. So, you know, there are some options. You'd also need to potentially play two games a week.
Yeah, that's... Unless you're going to accept that you can... basically, the games are immaterial. You can play an A team and a B team or whatever you want to call it, first team and a second team.
Well, it does raise some really interesting sporting questions, doesn't it? So I think the only thing that has to happen is there has to be some welfare ruling, no more than 80 minutes a week. Or, you know, well, it has to be 80 minutes. Because
pretty much,
if
yeah.
you say 100 minutes, is the referee going to take off a player if he exceeds his limits?
Yeah, it'd be no more than one full match per week. And as in, if that match goes to 85 minutes, that is a full match. If it goes to 80 minutes and 1 second, that is a full match.
Yeah, so, you know, you play Faf de Klerk second half and first half of two games, for instance, right?
Yeah.
But some really interesting sporting questions then of like, how do you put two squads together? Do you go full out every Saturday and then an A team? That's an interesting problem for them.
Who do you play? Who do you pick your best team against? So if you're playing Saracens, for example, or Exeter, do you put your best team to try and take points off them? Or do you play your best team against Leicester, Worcester?
Or half and half and try and do both?
Yeah, it creates... But even doing that, I still can't see how you can get this season done. And the big date in my head is this end of June, start of July date, which is when the players whose contracts end and the new contracts start, that's the cut-off date for them. And I just can't see how you maintain the league and the integrity of the league when you've got players switching.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes a different source of competition then, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also that's not insurmountable when you have broadcasters desperate for advertising money, you have clubs desperate for broadcasting money, and you have players desperate for contracts and money.
Yeah, true. The money is the big thing that's going to drive all of this.
Yes,
it will be whatever decision within certain parameters, but whatever decision gets most money to the clubs and the unions fastest.
So, would you be up for an 11-week tournament for the Premiership? Right, only 11 weeks.
Everyone plays each other once.
No, twice.
Oof.
Two games a week. But with the caveat that you can only see a player
for a full game
every week.
That, so a point that you've made in the past, JB, that feels like too much rugby.
Like that, I'd like that. Yeah. But there's no Premiership Cup.
As long as we can all stay on lockdown so we can just watch all this rugby, that's fine.
11 weeks, the season is...
We can have one game at 11 in the morning. At 1, 1 at 3, 1 at 5, 1 at 7.
So you'd have midweek matches, there'd be a match every night.
Match every night.
And then there'd be a bonanza of them over the weekend.
But you can't...
And then by week 12 or 13, the whole season would be over. Then they can look at European Cup, and then they can look at...
It's bonkers, mate. Obviously, you know, as you know, it's bonkers, but yeah.
I'd prefer it to do it fewer games. So split the league in two, six teams, five play every team once, not home and away, once. Bit of a look of the draw like the Six Nations, and then maybe take the top six through to playoffs.
So with 11 games, your senior players, your England players... Well, they'd have half the amount of Premiership appearances. You'd still have to play all the European games, which would occur after the Premiership season.
Well, all this, because there's I mean, one of the big things that we've not touched on in this pod, but we have touched on previous pods, and is an objective of both the potential chairman for World Rugby, is the amalgamation or the formation of a new world global calendar that meets the needs of club, domestic players, international. And I was thinking about that earlier this week and wondering if, so is it better to do the Northern Hemisphere option, which your international players get together three times a year, so Six Nations early on, Summer Tours middle, Autumn Internationals late on, or do it more like the objective for the Southern Hemisphere, which is you have your block of domestic at the start of the year, your Super Rugby, and then you get your internationals together for the remainder of the year, and you go into Rugby Championship and Autumn Internationals.
I've got to say, I do like, on paper, the idea of what the Southern Hemisphere do. That said, Six Nations is sacrosanct to me. But you could, I like it in the autumn. It's when it happens. Like
Six Nations in the autumn?
No.
No, that, sorry, that was just what you said.
Sorry, spring.
Spring, yeah, I was going to say. I think you could do that. I mean, you could have the Six Nations in the spring, but then go straight into your Summer Tours or Autumn Internationals immediately after that, or whatever that World League or whatever the intention for those games is, but keep all your international games in the first half of the year and all your highest level domestic games in the second half of the year.
One thing I do like, just as a principle in terms of ramping up, would be Premiership first block, then European Cup second block. So then you've gone from 12 to 6, to the best 6. Then you go to Six Nations, where you get the best of those players playing international rugby, and then you go to the multinational summer tour.
How about this? The first half of the season is 2 games a week. And then, then the business end extends to a game a week.
For the Prem, is that?
The Prem.
Yeah.
And that kicks off after the group stages for the Heineken Cup.
So I'd almost like it like Tim's, I think, suggesting there, where you have the Premiership done and dusted in, say, 3 months, then Europe done and dusted in 3 months or 2 months, and then your non-international players can play a Mitre Cup, Currie Cup type lower tier thing, and your internationals can go and play the other internationals.
Interesting. Well, it's all up for grabs now.
Yeah,
it certainly is.
One thing we do need to touch on before we go is apologise for the fact we haven't done a classic game this week.
Well, we're going to do it tomorrow, are we?
So I watched the Lions 2009 second test last night.
Yeah, which is what we were going to do because it was on Sky Sports, and unfortunately there just isn't a link.
I can't find one.
But well, the second test between the Lions and South Africa.
Well, I know what classic game that we can watch tomorrow.
Which one?
It's the Premiership final. Sale Leicester. And it's 8 o'clock tomorrow on Sale Sharks live feed.
In fact,
I think I've got the game on an MP4 file somewhere, which I can send to you boys so you can watch it in your leisure.
Is it available forever afterwards, or do you have to watch it?
Yeah, sure.
Well, no, is it? Is it only a live stream, then it's gone? Because otherwise that doesn't work. As we just found, because with South Africa, the Lions second test, you would have to have been watching Sky Sports live.
Yes, or record it.
I will have, a word with the powers that be and see if I can make it happen.
Okay, well, one thing I was thinking for maybe penance for not having done a game this week, or not having organised one, or ballsed up having a link for the South Africa Lions second test, I did think maybe as penance we should watch and talk about All or Nothing, the New Zealand documentary on Amazon.
Oh, I'd do that.
I can't do it.
I would do that. I'd like to do that.
JB's face right now is meaning I'm desperate for you to do it and talk about it, because your face right now,
you'd love to
hate it. You think of all that culture, JB.
So are you telling me I'm going to watch All or Nothing by tomorrow night?
No.
No, by next week.
Week.
We're watching Sale Leicester next week.
We can do that tomorrow. We can do that tomorrow, and we can get that one up. And then, because this is my point.
Oh, no, sorry. Sale Leicester is live streamed at 8 o'clock tomorrow.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So if Sale Leicester is on live stream tomorrow and it is then available thereafter, we can watch that, do a little midweek podcast this week about that.
I understand.
And then the big chunk of homework for this time next week is to watch All or Nothing, the New Zealand documentary on Amazon. Get all that culture in you.
If I have to, I will.
You'd love it, like you loved reading the first 100 pages or so of Stuart Lancaster's book.
Oh, there was one last thing, which was, how long have
you... So are we you committed to that then? So we'll do Sale midweek this week. So that's on the Sale Sharks Facebook page tomorrow. We'll put a link on our Twitter account and stuff. And then watch on Amazon, All or Nothing, the New Zealand documentary. Get that. But yeah, go on. Now,
perfect.
How long have we been recording for, Tim?
About an hour and a quarter, hour and 20.
All right, okay. So yeah, we've done an hour and a quarter. Some semi-rugby chat. The Sunday Times have run out of things to write about. This is official. This is worse than doing a Lions 15. In the Sunday Times, their top favourite grounds, their top 10 favourite grounds. I mean, this is like the realm of BuzzFeed in the bad old days.
Yeah, before BuzzFeed actually became a news organisation.
Yeah, top 10 grounds.
Well, I'd put air quotes around that, Phil.
A news organisation.
Yes. So, the incredible, the unbelievable Stephen Jones has mentioned such grounds as the Tottenham Hotspur ground, which has never played a rugby game. Tim just informed me of this prior to the podcast.
That was number 5 on his top 10 grounds for rugby, is the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And he says, by now, rugby would be inking plans for the first match in the new arena, Saracens v Harlequins. Coronavirus put paid to that. it is an amazing stadium, and I was going to be working that game. I was very much looking forward to it.
That would be good. I'd love to visit.
Don't forget the famous rugby stadium, the San Siro.
There was one game there once.
Did that hold a Heineken Cup game?
No, it was Italy v New Zealand. Just a rugby game.
So we went to the Stadio Olimpico, didn't we? I loved it.
Just to be clear, so the justification for the San Siro being one of the best rugby grounds, Italy staged a successful rugby occasion there against New Zealand, blah, 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 blah. But those fortunate enough to see Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band play there for nearly 4 hours will always rank it as deeply spiritual.
Oh my God.
I'd love to have seen that gig, to be fair, because Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band notoriously played for, they just never, just played forever. But,
if I went to a concert that I overran, I'd consider it rude. This is why I don't like concerts. I'd have plans, I'd want to go for a meal or some drinks afterwards. One thing
some bands have started doing, I think they've mainly done it for younger audiences, but and to double up on their money, but actually, this is what I would do. They've started doing matinee gigs, some bands. So they do one in the early evening, like 5 p.m., you get a whole new crowd, and you come in again for a 9 o'clock gig. So you get double bubble.
God, that's hard work.
God.
Yeah, it's double bubble, but I'd do the matinee one, because then, you get and still get to bed at a decent time.
So people are amazed. I was speaking to someone the other day. It wasn't the other day, because we've been on lockdown. And I told them, I've never been to a gig. And they were absolutely astonished that I'd never been to a gig. It does not interest me one single bit. 4 hours in there. I can't even imagine how bad that would be.
Hang on a minute. You told me you went to a gig. You went to an R. Kelly concert in South Africa.
In the second test.
Yes.
There's the second test. That is entirely correct.
To be fair to Stephen Jones, he's absolutely right on his number one stadium, which is the Principality Stadium.
He's absolutely not. He's not correct on that.
That was one of the best. Superb. It's an absolutely superb place to watch.
No. The RAC is the best stadium on the planet, including all in all sports. It is the RAC.
The RAC is great. The Marcel Michelin.
I've never been there, but I imagine that could be number one.
That was unreal.
You've done it, haven't you, Tim?
It was unreal. It was something. It was something else.
I really fancy that. Right? Maybe we should just actually do it. We've been talking about doing that for years.
Yeah, that should be a good one.
Yeah,
we get out of lockdown.
Yeah, exactly. Because we're not going to take it for granted anymore, are we?
Precisely.
No. We need to get back to Madrid to the little bowl, the grass bowl, and we need to get to Clermont. Because it's the highest percentage of Michelin star restaurants in the world as well in Clermont per capita.
There's the Stephen Jones list. The Stuart Barnes list is far superior. It's actually a good list.
Does it include the RAC? It must.
It does.
Millennium. It's like
Stuart Barnes. His number one stadium is the Stade Marcel Michelin. Number two, the Parc des Princes. Number three, Thomond Park. Yeah, that is a wicked place to watch rugby as well.
I'd love to do that as well.
Four, the RAC. Five, the National Stadium in Cardiff, the old
AJ Bell, Haywood Road, Edgeley Park.
Number six, Loftus-Versfeld in Pretoria. Number seven, King's Park in Durban. Number eight, the Stade Mayol, Toulon. That was pretty cool as well. The one I want to do in France is...
Did Stephen Jones misunderstand his brief?
Yeah. What's the French one that Joe Worsley was a coach at? Or maybe still. What team?
Is it Bordeaux?
B, begins with a B.
Bordeaux.
Yeah, I want to do Bordeaux. Ballymore in Brisbane and number 10, the Principality in Cardiff.
Fair play. That is a really good list. That actually reads like a list of places I want to go. And I can watch rugby. I can go to the San Siro and not see a game of rugby for the next 50 years.
Is it shutting down the San Siro?
I think it's been.
Has it already been shut down?
Locked down.
Mm. Yeah. One stadium that I have a real soft spot for because I went to university there, and it's changed. And Sandy Park's brilliant, but the County Ground at Exeter, there was something just a little bit special about that. It was so horrible.
It was the best ground, or one of the best sporting experiences I've been lucky enough to witness. Salford City Reds against Warrington. I think the lead changed hands like 7 or 8 times.
At the old place, what's it called? The Willows.
The Willows. Yeah. What a stadium that is.
The Willows. So Willows might be the first proper stadium I went to. I was a Salford Rugby League season ticket holder for a number of years when I was a kid.
I nearly got one. I enjoyed it so much there.
It's a real spit and sawdust type place. Real.
Go with the sawdust. The men's toilets. Have you ever been there, Tim?
No.
Well, just indulge me for 2 minutes then.
Yeah, no, I like it.
The back wall was the men's toilets, like legitimately. There was one brick wall and there's two gaps, which led you into another brick wall and like a trough, and that was the gents. The VIP were two porta cabins on stilts above two other porta cabins. And they had one stand, from what I remember. But they did have four stands.
Yeah, no, three stands.
Three stands, yeah, because the porta
cabins, one end is the clubhouse.
Yeah. And
there's three stands. One which was full standing, one which was full seating, and I think the end one, the opposite end to the clubhouse, was half and half.
Yeah, so when I went there for that game, there was 11,000 people in attendance.
There's more than that in some of the games as well. I remember watching Salford Wigan in a cup game when I was about 8 years old, and it was rammed, absolutely heaving.
There must have been
20,000 people in there.
Yeah.
More, probably.
I know that you know the answer to this, Phil, but Tim, do you know what the record was for people going to watch Bradford Bulls?
Bradford Bulls?
Yeah. At the Oddsall Stadium.
Oddsall Stadium, yeah.
And I'll give you the opposition as well. Halifax.
Local derby.
Local derby, yeah.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
$15,000 to $17,000.
Close, bit more.
Add 100,000 onto it, and you're close.
What? At the Oddsall Stadium?
I think it's 100.
Where? Where would they get? Was everyone on giving shot carries to another member of the crowd?
Well, I think it was 108,000.
Yeah, about that.
Oh my goodness.
108,000 went on Bradford Halifax.
Wow. Right, so you've just give me an idea. So we've got the for our penance and to get some culture.
Do you know what? For our penance, we should watch Bradford Halifax.
We're going to watch it. So we're going to watch All or Nothing. We're going to watch Sale v Leicester on the Sale Sharks Facebook page tomorrow. And what I'd put an appeal out, because we're missing grounds and live rugby, a sort of poetic description of your favourite rugby ground.
Sometimes the bad
or the run down descriptions can be brilliant. So if there's a ground you love, your local club ground or a ground you remember from the past, do it. Just send it to us in a sort of poetic fashion, and then because that description of the Willows is loved it.
It was an amazing ground, an incredible experience
going there.
That's right, an unbelievable experience.
Genuinely unbelievable.
Our email address is contacteggchasers@gmail.com. That's contacteggchasers@gmail.com. I think we're done.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think we're done.
Sweet.
Good stuff.
Have a lovely week. What home CrossFit box session have you got planned for tomorrow, JB?
I don't know. I like to plan them with my coffee outside. So I'll kind of think about it. And they're not all that CrossFit-y. Quite a lot of them. Well, yeah, no, they are actually. They are.
I put it on
the whiteboard too, like I'm competing.
There are literally thousands of free CrossFit sessions.
There are
actually. On the internet.
Yeah, I'm going to now go for a 5K run.
Now?
Right now.
Fair play. Tim, are you going to be doing any more rowing this week?
No, because I'm decorating my daughter's bedroom, so her bed has been dismantled, and before it gets sold on Gumtree, it's in my room, so I can't put the rower down now. I'll be doing another cycle tomorrow, I think.
Did you see Chris Bentley?
Yes.
Exeter.
Chris Bentley did a 1 hour row maximum distance for in 1 hour, rather than it being a distance in the fastest time. This was a time, how far can you row? And he did over 16,000 meters in an hour with an average split time of, I think it's like 151.8, something like that, over an hour, which is
so that's stupid awesome. Questions. Is that good?
That's really good. It's
very, very good.
Very good. And his stroke rate was 21 strokes per minute, which shows that he was... So I rowed a little bit at university, and when you get the technique right on a rower, that's part of it. And when you see someone doing high splits with a low stroke rate, they'll have bang on technique, and long levers as well helps.
Yeah.
Do you know who is a superb rower, allegedly?
Courtney Laws.
Rugby player, yeah. Second rules.
Matt Simmons.
Oh well, he was a rower, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was an actual rower, and he said like the levels of fitness he achieved in rowing were far in excess of what he achieves playing rugby.
Yeah, but it's in terms of a fitness thing, it is so single dimensional. Like you just have the huge engine, his power and engine compared to rugby, which is there are a lot more facets to it.
So one brilliant documentary, I don't know if it's on the internet or something, but Going for Gold, the I think it was a 3-episode documentary leading up to the Sydney Olympics, and it was following the Great British Four, Redgrave, Pinsent, Tim Foster and James Cracknell.
Yeah.
It was amazing that there are times when they do their rowing tests on the rowing machine and they finish it and they have literally not even got the energy left to keep their body upright. They just collapse. And they look like they're dead.
I watched the CrossFit documentary or a CrossFit documentary last night, like before, about the Abu Dhabi.
Apparently you burn like hundreds of calories just by watching it.
Yeah.
Psychosomatic.
They've got one workout called the acid bath, which is just three concept machines. So the concept two row or whatever it is, the ski machine or something else.
Yeah.
And when these guys are finishing it, and you know how fit they are, they're crawling over the finish line. They're getting off this this cross training. I don't know what's the little war bikey thing. I don't know
attack bike. Yeah, or the what bike or attack bike or one of the two. Yeah. The one with the forward and back hand thing.
Yeah, that's the one. So
the hands move and the pedals. Yeah,
that's the last of the three exercises, and they come off it and they crawl over the line. It looks disgusting. It's called the acid bath.
Yeah, those things are horrible. You will have done far more of this than me, Tim, but like we used to do competitive 10 lots of 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, and you're against a partner and you're trying to get the highest total distance. And when you can do it on your own and you can push yourself kind of hard, but when you know it's competitive, it's horrendous.
It is horrendous.
Absolutely kills you.
I never want to do an attack bike ever again.
Right, all or nothing by next week, everyone. Contact at edchasers.com with your thoughts. Sale versus Leicester 2006 Premiership Final on the Sale Sharks Facebook page tomorrow night and or at any point afterwards on that site. And then any thoughts you have, contact edchasers at gmail.com or at Rugby Podcast on Twitter. Slide into the DMs. He's at Jay Beardmore. I'm at Cocker. Phil, he'll let you know where he is. And that's that. Good. I can't believe we chatted for so long.
I can.
Some of it was all right as well. Some of it was all right.
Some of it was
rugby. Nice one. Take care, gents.
Cheers, guys.
See you the next one. Laters.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.